Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Hello, good morning. Come on in. Grab a seat or whatever. Stand up. Keep driving. My name is Jesse. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the one and only campus community radio station way up here on Burnaby Mountain, where we broadcast on the unceded and ancestral territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Stolo, Catesy, Kwikwetlem, and other Coast Salish peoples. My name, I already told you, is Jesse, and this is the program where we play talk content. Sometimes we talk, sometimes we listen to interviews recorded by other people, sometimes we do interviews, all that stuff, and of course, just generally hang out and get you ready for the rest of the day. Today on the program, we got a couple more interviews from PA Department Work Study William, and a little bit of the music in between. And of course, as always, we are starting with a little bit of local content. This track is from local soul band The Van Rays, from their new record, Hey, All Right Now. This one is called Lightning. Lightning by the Van Rays here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. A good way to get the morning started. Thanks for hanging out with me this hour. And now I'm going to give you a, well, it's not quite an interview. It is a recording of a speaking engagement featuring Muqaddisa Sarwari, who is a student and activist. And I will let you listen to this. Well, we'll listen to it together, I guess. And then I'll be back.
For hosting us, I'm going to just ask Mr. Baldwin, who, without him, we wouldn't be here today, to say a few words.
Yeah. First of all, thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm sorry about the technical difficulties and the late start. This screen is very finicky and sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. We try everything. I'm very sorry about that. I won't take up too much time. I will say that we are on the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish Tsleil-Waututh speaking people. A little bit of history about that. We used to say Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish nations, but the city of Burnaby, in consultation with the local nations, it was requested that we actually use language groups, Hunkaminam and Squamish Tsleil-Waututh speaking people, because there are smaller nations, and that encapsulates all of the nations, as opposed to the three big ones that are on this land. I think it's especially pertinent when we do land acknowledgements to kind of connect it to what we are here for. We're here to hear a story about someone who came to Canada as a refugee. And when we think about settlers on this land and settler colonialism and the role of multiple nation states in creating refugee crises, we have to think about what is the connection for those people who left their land, in many cases, land that is sacred, to come here to be on unceded territory. It's very complicated relationships. And so just to take a moment to acknowledge that, we thank the nations that we are able to be here to listen to this talk, to learn, hopefully to laugh together today, and to have some donuts and coffee. And so thank you all for being here again. I'm just going to sit back here if anybody has any questions for me. There is a washroom, which I can guide you to, but just down the hallway there, that's just for adults. And so again, welcome everybody. Thank you.
I'm not going to introduce Muqaddisa because Muqaddisa is going to speak for herself. She'll tell you all about her story. I'd like to tell you why I wanted to do this. So I work for Mosaic. I work with newcomers, predominantly refugees. I see resilience every single day. It's incredible. Muqaddisa is exceptional, right? But you're exceptional because you're willing to share your story. You remind us that we are all immigrants, except for the people on whose unceded land we live and work and get to call ourselves immigrants. You remind me of my parents, two people who up and left their home and said, hey, we're moving to Canada and we're going to make this work. The important thing that I would hope that everybody, that I take from my work and I see every day, and I hope we all get to take from this discussion or from your story, is that we all have similar stories. And the important thing is to share them as much as we can. Floor is yours, please.
Thank you, everyone, so much for being here today. It is honestly a pleasure and an honor to be in your presence. A huge thank you to Mosaic, Monica, Maggie, Leslie, and Val for being here today. I am more than happy to be here to share my journey and tell you a little bit more about my life, where I come from, and the things that I've learned over the years. My name is Muqaddisa Sarwari. I am originally a Hazara from Afghanistan. And to tell you a little bit more about myself, I would have to take you a few years back because I arrived in Canada around 4 years ago, at the very ending of 2019. So I got about 3 months of peace before COVID hit, and I got used to my life here, which is really good. But to tell you about the journey of my life, a significant part of it would begin right before I came to Canada. Because before I arrived in Canada, me and my family moved to Indonesia in 2015 to pursue a safer life for ourselves. We moved to Indonesia to be refugees and asylum seekers under the UNHCR. Because we knew that in order for us to leave our homelands and pursue a safer home for the future, we had to go through a system and to be asylum seekers and refugees. So when I first arrived in Indonesia, it was like foreign land to me. It's very far from where I come from Central Asia, and it was a very exciting time for me to be in a completely new environment. And most importantly, it felt like it was the very first step towards beginning a new life for myself. And honestly, I had high expectations. Since I knew this was the very first time that I was taking this step towards my future, I was excited to make new friends. I was excited to start a new school and start my classes and play sports with my friends. It was very quickly that we learned that refugees and asylum seekers who do live in Indonesia under the UNHCR have no legal right to attend school, to have employment, or any of the basic human rights. So at the very young age that I arrived in Indonesia, I was told that I couldn't go to school. A 10-year-old girl who had just big dreams for herself, who was excited to go and begin a new life, was told that she could not attend school because it was not allowed. And at first, this hit hard because even from a young age, as an Afghan girl, education was at the very forefront of my dreams. And so having that one thing that always gave me hope being taken away from me hit really hard. And it was not just me. There were thousands of other refugee children just like myself, younger and older, who were in Indonesia that were told they were not able to go to school. They were not able to grow, further themselves, learn more, have a job, take exams, and make friends at school. However, it was not all at a loss, because the refugee community actually came together and we made this little makeshift school that was made by refugees for refugees. And this little makeshift school was in a broken, run-down house that was rented in the middle of a residential neighborhood. We rented this house. My teachers were just a few years older than I was. And we had about four subjects: English, math, geography, and science. We had about seven classrooms, and the maximum grade that we had was grade 8. So in my classes, it wasn't based on age. It was just based on the level that you had learned. So I was 12 years old in a class with an 18-year-old, a 16-year-old, and we were all together in one classroom coming together to learn. And so I had this newfound place, and this place that gave me hope, a place that showed to me that I had a community, people that were just like myself. And this place became my new home. Even though it was just 4 days a week, 4 hours a day, I would walk and march up to the school with excitement to learn something new and to make a brighter future for myself. The most exciting part about that little school was the structure that it gave my life. Because you see, being a refugee felt like being in a limbo. There was no way I could go back to my homeland, and there was also no way forward. Because there was so much uncertainty into whether or not we would be able to find a permanent home. So having this school gave me this sense of identity and this self of structure. There was a place that I would go to each morning, get to my classes, and it was the one thing that I could predict in my life, while everything else around me was so uncertain. It was a place that gave me so much hope and gave me the friends that I have to this day. And so the school was entirely run by donations. It was this little house with seven rooms separated by thin plywood. And every day we would show up, take our shoes off at the entrance, march up on the carpeted floors of the rooms, turn on the lights. And we had no desk, so we would just sit cross-legged on the floor, and with our bright faces, we would look towards our teachers. Our teachers were just volunteers who were giving up their precious time to learn whatever they had and to give it to the students. And so me and my classmates would sit right next, huddled next to each other, cross-legged on this carpet, and we would learn what we could. We had a pencil in our hands, a notebook in front of us, and we were excited to learn. And so this was a place that allowed for me to dream. It was a place that gave me the new sense of identity that I had. And in fact, many of the friends that I had in Indonesia are people that are still there to this day. And a very specific day that I remember in that little school, for a lot of you that don't know, is that Indonesia is a very tropical country. So people complain about Vancouver rain, wait until you go to Indonesia, because it rains all the time and the weather is gloomy. And the rain is not a joke. It rains, rains. There's thunderstorms, there's floods. And we lived in a very rural area. So when it would rain, almost everything would stop. And one day in school, it was the morning, and it was a gloomy morning. It was raining really, really hard. And we had three rows of students, a bucket, and another three rows of students, and a bucket. Because our ceilings would start to drip down with water, and we would hold that bucket in there so it would fill up with water so that we would not get wet. And that little bucket is what we use for as our trash cans. And we would have to go to all the other classrooms, and people were stealing buckets from each other so their classrooms and the carpets wouldn't get wet. And although now I look back at this fondly, and it becomes a funny memory to me now, back then it was difficult to know that I am a young person just like any other in any part of the world. But for me, my school was so different. My classroom was worlds and universes different than the classrooms of other children in other parts of the world. And back then, I didn't understand what made me so different from these other kids. The place that we were born, the country that we happened to be from, dictated the life that we were living right now. But despite everything, I felt hopeful and I felt excited to know that my teachers were just volunteers. They were people who were 20 years old, 21 maybe, who were coming here, volunteering their time to teach us something. The kids that I was sitting next to, we had almost nothing in common other than the fact that we lived there and that we were refugees. We had a variety of ages, a variety of places that people came from, but the fact that I was able to build such strong connections with these people, because we could relate so much to each other, it felt like we were in the same boat in the middle of a storm. And we were doing whatever we could to give each other company and to make each other feel supported. And even though in my school, I knew that there was almost no certainty going into the future, because this school stopped at grade 8. And if I had stayed in Indonesia for a year or two more, I would have to become a teacher. Because once you graduate from that school and you no longer are able to be a student, the students would then become teachers and then would volunteer their time and go back to the school as someone who could teach something else. And the most inspiring part to me about the school was the fact that we didn't just sit there and let life happen to us. We knew we were in a very dire situation, and we knew that this is the cards that life had given us. So instead of just sitting there and letting years and the years and the years go by, we were able to do something, take a step forward, to help each other, to build a community, and learn from each other. And when you are in a moment where there's so much darkness and so much uncertainty, you start to find hope and happiness in the little things in life. For example, in my school, in my class, we have this thing called a sports day. And essentially, it was just one day out of the week where we could go into our little courtyard in front of the school, we would get a ball, we would throw it around, and we'd start to play football or we'd start to play volleyball. And it was little things like that that really kept my family and the students in that school going. But the most difficult part was that once you stepped out of that school, you began to think about where your life is really going. And that's the most difficult part, because we had no idea and we were so uncertain on the direction that our life was going. We had no decision and no say in what country we went to, when we went, and which city we went to. But the only thing and the most important thing for us was to have that hope and know that we are hoping for a better and brighter future. So after spending 5 very long and difficult years in Indonesia, my family and I were one of the very few lucky people who were able to escape and make Canada our new home. And once I left Indonesia, I couldn't believe that I started to miss it more and more. And the reason I missed it was because of the community that I made. because I was always surrounded by people who were so similar to me. They shared the same story, and they were just as ambitious to me as me, and just as determined. So after 5 long years, my family and I were very lucky to leave Indonesia and arrive in Vancouver. And you can imagine just how excited I was. After 5 long years, I finally was able to have everything that I ever wanted. And this was small things. Going to a classroom, having a locker. I was excited to give exams. I was that desperate. I mean, I was so excited to be in this very new country and have all these opportunities that I wished for. And it was strange to me that all my other Canadian classmates didn't seem to have the same perspective. And that's when I knew that there was such a big barrier between me, the life that I had lived, compared to the people here, even though we were the exact same age. And that was one of the things that inspired me to continue to do the advocacy work that I do and to share the stories of my friends that I left behind in Indonesia. Because to this day, I have friends who are my age, and they're still left behind with no way to go forward and no way to build a future for themselves. Just a few months ago, I was very blessed to have my citizenship, my Canadian citizenship, and I got my Canadian passport. And that, to me, was an exciting moment. And I began to think that if I held this Canadian passport and I flew to Indonesia today, my life would be completely different compared to the friends that I left behind. Because those people are almost frozen in time. The life that I have and the life that they have is completely different just because of the opportunities that they didn't have access to. I'm no more deserving or no more different than they are. We just happen to be lucky enough to be in a country or a place where we have the resources to do what we can. So that was a moment of enlightenment to me to realize I lived this life and I was surrounded by these people. Yet to this day, my classmates have no idea. The people that I go to school with have no idea that there exists a world like this where people, children, are barred from school. Where you go to school and you fear that the authorities are going to come and raid the school and shut it down. None of my classmates in Canada could believe that there exists a world in which these children are living in fear because they aren't allowed to go to school. And there are many children to this day that have gotten so much older and missed out on so much life and so much growth. And it pains my heart to see that. And it pains my heart to know that I was just one of them. And I think that's why the most important thing that I tell anyone that I meet in Canada is to always be grateful for what we have. Because our life here is incredibly, incredibly different from the lives of millions of people across the world. Even the tiniest things that we have access to, our resources, our opportunities, they are so valuable. And no matter how much we can get wind up in our schedules and complain about our lifestyles, there is someone out there that is wishing to be in your place. And gratitude is one of the very first things that I learned when I first came to Canada. To realize that I wished for these little things my entire life, and now I just get access to them. Things like university, teachers that care about you, your backpack full of textbooks and a laptop, roads that you can walk on as pedestrians, buses that come on time. These are the very little things that I wished for. And it's crazy to think that from such a young age, I was wishing for just these basic things. And so I learned that gratitude can come a long way. And that although life results in all of us being in very different places, we can do what we can with what we have. And that's what we did back in Indonesia. We focus on what we did have as compared to what we did not have. And those people, they took what they had, they rented that building, they took the carpets from home, they bought those whiteboards, and they sat in a classroom and did whatever they could. And I think that's one of the things that we often overlook. In a society like Canada, we are extremely lucky to be living and to be surrounded by so much support systems. And so when I finally came to Canada, I was excited to know that there are people like you, who are here to listen, who are here to share their stories, and who are here to be a source of support for someone, no matter how little that may be. And just, it's crazy to think, because just a few months ago, I finished my very first year of university at UBC, studying whatever I want, classrooms filled with like-minded students. And it's almost impossible to believe that just 4 years ago, I was sitting in that classroom thinking that there is no future for me. because there was no way forward. I would have never believed that I would get to a day where I could go to a university class, listen to my lecturer, and do my homework on a laptop. And life has a funny way of revealing things to you. And although those 5 years ago, that person that I was completely different, she would have never imagined or even predicted that something like this would happen. And so I've made it now my mission to advocate for all the stories of these people who are left behind, and way more people that are being forgotten day by day. And it's important for me to realize that I'm now in a position where I'm able to advocate for those who were left behind. And I'm really blessed to be in a society, in a community that respects and honors these stories and are willing to listen. And one of the most empowering things for me is to listen to other people who are just in the same shoes that I was and to be able to support them. Last year, I was able to deliver a TED Talk at TEDx Surrey where I listed my journey from Indonesia and the things that I'd been through. And after I got off the stage and I met with the people and the audience members, one of the girls came up to me. And she was a girl that looked like me, that was just like me. She was also a newcomer and refugee from Afghanistan. She came up to me with a face full of smiles and a face full of excitement, and she hugged me. I had no idea who this girl was, but instantly I felt that connection, and instantly I knew that whatever I was doing, at least it was helping someone. She told me that she was proud that a girl like her, from the place that she was from, and the things that she had been through, was a voice, and to be able to tell a story just like hers. And the most important thing to remember is that refugees are humans, just like everyone else. And although we have very unique circumstances and we come from very different parts of the world, we all share that common goal to build a better life for ourselves and to create a future that we can be proud of. Many times, being in a classroom, being in high school, or being in university, I hear a lot of the stereotypes that people set on refugees. People think that refugees are very specific type of people who come from a specific type of place. But the reality of it is, refugees can be just as dynamic as everyone else. And that we have the talent and the potential that it takes. We were just unlucky enough to be born in a certain part of the world. And if we are giving the small amount of support and the little push that it takes, refugees are able to make incredible things happen. And so today, on World Refugee Day, I urge you all to be grateful and to take in the things that you surround yourself with. And to take a moment to think about all of the things that you have and how grateful you should be to be in a community that is so supportive. And to keep in mind that there are refugees all around the world who are struggling to see a future for themselves. It is an incredibly difficult and heart-shattering to be in a place where you have no idea what's in front of you. As a mother, you have no idea where your children are going to go. As a child, you have no idea what it would be like to grow up, what country you're going to go into. So I stand in front of you today, not just as a personal accomplishment, but to be a voice and to be an example of all the refugee kids that exist all around the world that are doing whatever they can to build a better future for themselves. And that we have stories and that we have our own personal lives and dreams and accomplishments that we're so passionate about. And all we want is for you to listen, to understand, and to do what you can to help, and to offer that support that they may not have been given. And once again, I thank you all for being here and for listening to this story. And just remember to always be grateful for the things that are around you, and that refugees are absolutely capable, and we just need that little amount of support. So thank you.
Thank you to Public Affairs Department Work Study William for recording that talk. You can find out more about Mosaic Settlement and Employment Services for Newcomers at mosaicbc.org. I'll be right back. In the meantime, this is Radio Halo by Chimeras. Welcome back to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, Campus Community Radio at Simon Fraser University. I'm Jesse. We are just over halfway through the show. And now I'm going to play you an interview conducted by PA Department Work Study William with Noel from SFPIRG, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group. Just giving you a little bit more information on their programs and what they're all about. So we will hear that now. Welcome back here on... Oops, that's the wrong part. I'll actually play you the first part. That seems like probably the right thing to do. Here we go.
All right, hey, this is William Hofzink with CJSF Speak Up, and today I am with Noel of SFUPIRG. Noel, can you give me a little bit of a brief overview?
Hi, my name is Noel. I work at the SFPIRG, which is the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group. I'm there as the Director of Engagement, and I'm super excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, excellent. So, Noel, tell me a little bit about yourself. What really like got you engaged in public interest and social justice in general? Because I know it's a very different story for everybody.
Yeah, I think for me, I feel like I've always been kind of a person who likes to do political sort of work. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until like college where I really met other folks that were doing that sort of work in a way that made sense to me.
Right.
I went to a university in the United States, and there was just a really rich tradition of sort of Black radical organizing there. So I sort of took a lot of my thinking and practice from that time. And that's sort of what got me into doing like public interest and also just like political organizing in general.
You told me you were at Brown for a couple of semesters. Like, how do you think the experience at like an Ivy League school in the U.S. differs from back in Canada? Like, do you think there was a huge cultural shift and like a way that in which activism is portrayed? If I'm making sense.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways there isn't really differences. I think there's like a lot that is like with a lot of different universities, like they offer the same things, but there is this sort of image of prestige and this image of a kind of like unique type of learning that I don't think is. I guess just like in the same ways that you have like classes filled with like hundreds of people here that like don't maybe like have the most resources or folks don't get a ton of time with professors and things, like those problems sort of like translate across. I think the difference the biggest differences have to do with like people's access to resources after they graduate and even during their time there. I think that, you know, a lot of people, there are a lot of like communities that, what's the best way to put this? I guess just that like a lot of the ties that people form at, I think like Ivy Leagues or just like elite institutions in general, you often have people in industry, people who are, you know, working in other like parts of the economy that will gravitate to hiring those people and gravitate to bringing those people on into their sort of parts of the division of labor. And I think what that means is that a lot of folks that go to these kinds of schools have advantages when they're going on the job market. But outside of that, it's not like you get like any kind of like special like new niche knowledge or anything like that. You're going to like study calc here, you're going to study calc exactly there. It's going to be like the same education. So I think the advantages on the job market are really the big difference. And I think a lot of that has to do also with like nepotism and these things that are like endemic at these places. So
daddy donated a building.
Yeah, daddy donated a building, and now I get to come to class whenever I want and never do assignments and all the nine. Those are the differences I think that come to mind.
Yeah, so I know that there's a huge work study program at SFU. I know I'm actually part of it because of my financial situation. But do you think that there's a lot of draw to people who might be in a similar situation that I am to public interest groups? Or do you think there's a way you can like maybe expand the net there? Because I don't know. Like, I think that there's a lot of I think there's a lot of great opportunities to be had in public interest research, not just for people who not just for people who are already interested, but like, how do you think you can get more people engaged?
Well, one of the things that we're doing right now, I'll say, we're sort of working on a new project that feels exciting to sort of bring people on to our like work study and volunteering and just into the perg in general. I will say one of the things that we're doing right now that and have been doing for a little while that is through the work study is the LFTI program, or the Letters for the Inside.
Tell me a little about that.
So that program is basically a program where folks that are incarcerated make different kinds of like research and information requests to folks on the outside, and then we sort of like craft responses to try and share as much like knowledge and information across these sort of like prison walls that are not very porous when it comes to information and knowledge that is like allowed to move, and so to sort of undermine that control that the state has over what people can know and access in prison, we sort of do these sort of research requests and engage in these sort of pen pally kind of relationships.
Like, it almost makes me wonder too about kind of recidivism being a bit of like a closed circuit too, because with that lack of information spent and the time spent within the walls of prison, do you think it might make it even harder for someone to readjust into civilian life and maybe find themselves in more criminogenic environments, criminogenic situations?
I think that, to me, I think that would be one of, like, many things that, like, make, like, a recidivism happen. Like, I think that definitely, like, folks... like access to information could be a part of that. I think in general, just people's like connectedness to other humans, like so much of, I think like what the prison tries to do is really just isolate people, and sort of make them feel very, very alone. Or at least that's how I understand it, not having actually been, inside myself. And so I think that, yeah, cutting people off from information and knowledge is one part of that. But I think that there's so many, different forces at work that produce recidivism as a kind of phenomenon, and this revolving door that is the prison, where folks exit and then come back in.
I totally understand there. Like, it almost feels counterintuitive when you're denying someone who wants to improve, wants to make up for their crimes, no matter like how horrifying or portrayed as horrifying, because obviously like we don't know the full story, then they want the information to be able to turn over a new leaf, and yet they just don't get that. And speaking of like information too, I can tell that the PERG has like this incredible collection of literature and of artwork as well. Can you tell me a little bit about some of like the highlights you've been reading or you would recommend? Because there's a book club too.
Ooh, oh my goodness. Sort of also connected to our new work study project, or one of an emerging one, which is our like People's University project, a sort of program for political education. And so we're doing some study groups and some teach-ins through that. One of the books that is going to be a sort of study group for us is going to be How Europe Underdeveloped Africa by Walter Rodney, which I would highly recommend to anyone. It's a sort of work on underdevelopment in Africa and sort of political economy in general. It's really, really fantastic, and sort of like argues, I think in a lot of ways, or tries to demonstrate the need for like Africa to break from the sort of like international capitalist system. So that is a really cool book. One that I've been reading lately that I finished recently was The Caliban and the Witch, which was a really good book.
I caught you reading that on the bus too. Yeah.
No way. I've definitely read it quite a bit on the bus. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little about that too? Because from my understanding, it's like kind of taking a Marxist feminist perspective on the economy throughout history, or
yeah, exactly. It's sort of attempts to revisit primitive accumulation in Marx's works, which is like sort of this time or this sort of idea that is all about like capitalism coming into being, like what accumulation has to happen in order for capitalism to start to stand on its own legs. And so often people think of like colonialism, people think of enslavement, but one of the sort of examples, the historical examples that Silvia Federici kind of goes to is the witch hunts. And the witch hunts as an example or a sign of kind of primitive accumulation and the role that the witch hunts had in sort of alienating women and femme people and folks in general from their own bodies.
Yes.
And their ability to sort of assert their own agency in the sort of human reproductive process, right? Because what she sort of argues is that in the sort of entire scheme of things, right, we think of, you know, Marx is really interested in production. He's really interested in, like, how we make things and all this kind of stuff. And a big part of that, like, one of the commodities that gets made, and he sort of calls a commodity himself, is labor power, right? Our literal life being, the thing that we, the thing that we all have, the ability to, like, kind of work in labor. And she sort of points out that, it's sort of women I guess you could say like just like folks who are engaged in a certain kind of reproductive labor that actually produce labor power. And so we've kind of not really explored that idea enough, and she
like the specific role of like the feminine in the means of production, like
Sort of understanding, I think, like, the body as a part of the means of production.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Right? And the ways that the capitalist class, right? One of the examples she gives, which is really cool, is that, you know, in the sort of, like, late feudal period, the sort of end of the Middle Ages, you have the Black Death, which kills, like, a bunch of people. And, like, a third of Europe's population. And so this creates, like, a situation that's actually really good for wage workers because there's, like, less competition in the labor market. And so that means that they can sort of, you know, have higher wages or push for higher wages in a way that is difficult for the capitalist class. And so what she sort of argues is that the capitalist class, in concert or in tandem with, you know, the feudal nobility and these sort of other interests, they actually go to huge extents to prevent, or rather to encourage or force women to reproduce so that they can actually increase the population and sort of like dampen the sort of win that workers had in a certain sense when there was a lower population. And so we see sort of like all kinds of stigma associated with like non-procreative sex come at this time, right?
Exactly, especially with the impact of the church too.
And
even
so
tying back to the witch hunt. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Carry on.
No. 1,000%. Right. We see like stigma against homosexuality. We also see like the sort of criminalization of all kinds of like contraceptive activity, right? Which are sort of like tied to what folks understand as witches. So many different things. We see the introduction, or the removal of midwives from the birthing process, and sort of male doctors being responsible for the birthing process, and these sort of like demographic statistics beginning to like be taken and emerge to account for the population increases and all these things. So, sorry, that was me going off on
no,
and
that was amazing. Yeah, no,
we'll be right back with the second half of William and Noelle's conversation here on CJSF.
I'm Javin and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
here on CJSF. Now pleased to bring you the second half of William's interview with Noel from the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group.
I think, like, one of the beautiful things about the Purg, especially when I first, like, engaged myself with the material and especially, like, the literature, there's so many different marginalized perspectives you can draw from. Like, there you had those books of W.E.B. Du Bois, and you had a lot of great LGBT authors, but I still see I still see a lot of division in marginalized groups, like, who gets to speak? Like, there are a lot of anti-transgender activists who identify as LGBT, even in this book I've been reading, ML Ferris's My Favorite Thing Is Monsters, there's an incredible scene, it's heartbreaking, in the first book where the main character's best friend, they are accosted on, this is set in the 1960s, they're accosted on a bus by a fellow black man, and at the time this person identifies as a black man, but they later go on to identify as a transgender woman, and they get accosted with all these, like, slurs, and, like, they're even told straight up, like, following the death of MLK, like, this, their kind is not for civil rights. And it's just an honestly heartbreaking scene to see so much division in a time when, like, unity is needed the most. And obviously, like, we've progressed a lot in accepting transgender folks and LGBT folks, people of, like, not, like, non-traditional religious backgrounds too, but do you think there's a way that we can even improve, like, unity among the marginalized even more so?
Absolutely. I think that you know, one of the things that makes me think of is also the ways that we're watching, like, a kind of, like, reversal of, like, the sort of, like, move toward acceptance, and this sort of, like, this world where, you know, queer and trans folks have become increasingly safe. I think when we look to the United States, when we look to the bathroom bills, when we look to all of these sorts of, like, kinds of, like, legislation that criminalize, like, drag, and we see these, like, also forms of legislation starting to emerge in, like, conservative parts of this country, or through different kinds of, like, conservative parties being introduced to the legislatures. I think that there's so much to be done. And I think that... I think there's lots of ways that can look, but I think a big part of that will just, I think, be, one, like, building people's, like, political consciousness and growing people's political consciousness all the time, which, you know, people are doing, and there's lots of people working on that, but the more the merrier, and I also think, you know, really defending queer and trans folks' rights and understanding that a lot of the things that queer and trans folks need and deserve and are fighting for, things that we all kind of need and deserve and are fighting for. Like, I think about, you know, you talked about, like, radical activists that, you know, are anti-trans, but maybe call themselves LGBT. I think about the ways that, you know, trans folks kind of struggle for body sovereignty. It feels very similar to the struggle of folks with vaginas to, you know, sovereignty over their own bodies when it comes to sort of, like, reproductive rights and these kinds of things. So I think there's so many ways that, you know, we're really all on the same team, like, or we're all, like, kind of asking for the same stuff. So I hope that those things become, like, bases for unity and sort of points that we can align on and places where bridges can be built.
I agree completely. Like, I know my experience is a bit different, but as a person with a disability, right, I see a lot of infighting too on that front, whether it be from people with physical versus invisible disabilities, or even just other marginalized groups, or even, like, companies that put up a face to say that they're all for inclusion, but then when it actually comes to down to the complexities of integrating more accessible work environments, whether that be on the basis of race, on the basis of sexuality, on the basis of ability, they just balk under it because it's too much of a a cost. But what people don't see is like when you take the time to accommodate other people, the accommodations improve the quality of whether it be pedagogy, whether it be employment, just for production for everyone. Mm-hmm. Like, so I think, yeah, you couldn't have said it any better. Okay, I think we've gone and covered quite a lot of ground. It was an absolute pleasure having you on the air. Is there any like closing statements you'd like to make, like plug your socials or the Perg in general?
Yeah, you can find us on Instagram at SFPerg, just SFPIRG. We're also on Facebook. We have a website. And sort of coming up for us, the LFTI program, or the Letters for the Inside, we do, or are having rather, a little volunteer day, an onboarding session that's going to be happening on June 24th from 2 to 4:30. So come by for that. Stay in tune, stay in touch, follow us so you can know what we're doing next. And we can't wait to see you.
Woo! All right, that was Noelle with William on CJSF Speak Out. Tune in next time. Adios.
Thanks to William and Noelle for that interview. And that's about it for the show. I'm going to leave you with something a little heavy. So strap in, enjoy this, and then enjoy Democracy Now. See you next week. Oh yeah, this is Mother Buzzer by Gadfly.